You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, tax day is upon us once again, and while most of us have spent the past several weeks calculating just how much we owe the government, several large corporations and defense contractors are doing all they can to avoid paying anything. Yesterday, Peace Watch spoke with John Cavanaugh, director of the Washington-based Institute for Policy Studies. In the second part of our interview, he accuses the Bush administration of distracting the public from the excesses caused by corporate giants like Enron by focusing the attention on Iraq.
There are three groups of companies that you could accuse of war profiteering now over this war, and all of them do make good profits, but there's been a global economic recession since the middle of 2000, and so none of them are doing as well as they did in the heyday of the 1990s. And those are they're the firms, they're the defense contractors led by Raytheon and Boeing and so on, Lockheed Martin. Then there are the big oil companies, which stand to benefit greatly from getting Iraqi oil. And then there are the companies like Halliburton and Bechtel and Fluor, who will gain from what look to be as much as $75 billion to $100 billion in reconstruction contracts, which right now, by the way, are only going to American companies. So those three sets of companies, all of them are doing not as well as they were doing in the days of global boom of the 90s. And so this war and its aftermath are becoming a real boon to them and pulling some of them out of what have been somewhat difficult times.
Mm-hmm.
So you have one segment. I'll just say, let me say one more thing about this. You do have, therefore, a big segment of the business community that are huge supporters of this war. I will also say that I have watched other companies in other sectors who are, I think, nervous about the overall stance of the Bush administration, about its unilateral foreign policy, about its creating tensions and fights with European allies. I think there are other corporations who aren't benefiting directly from the war who are appalled at watching the United States break up the sort of alliances that help them do business.
Mm.
So I don't think that this war is 100% a war of global big business. It's helping certain sectors, in particular the oil companies and the reconstruction firms, but it isn't necessarily helping all large corporations.
And if you're in the business of weapons, then war is certainly good for business.
Absolutely. The weapons makers, the oil companies, and the reconstructors, those are the companies you can expect to make the most money and to be at the core of the funding for Bush's reelection. But he does not have full uniform corporate backing. I think his extremist stance in the world right now and around this war is making other segments of big business nervous. And it's something that could come back to haunt him when his team gets set on re-election in 2004.
You cite in your report the example of Kellogg Brown and Root, which is a subsidiary of Vice President Dick Cheney's company, Halliburton, and their open-ended contract to provide logistics supports to the U.S. troops in the Iraq War, which could earn them, millions of dollars. But what was startling to me was the amount of taxes Kellogg paid in 1999.
Yes, this is a great example. This company, by the way, is making money in many different ways. It also does have this open-ended contract for rebuilding Iraq's oil wells, and there is word out today that this could amount to contracts of as much as $7 billion. So Halliburton could still be the biggest corporate winner from this war. It's amazing. In 1998, though, Halliburton overall paid only $302 million in taxes. This is small compared to their profits. And in 1999, the company actually not only paid no taxes, it got an $85 million tax refund. And this is one of the most profitable companies in the world right now.
So I want you to repeat that. You're saying that in 1999, Kellogg Brown and Root actually ended up paying no taxes?
They paid no taxes, and not only did they pay no taxes, but their firm, Halliburton, got a tax rebate. So this would be considered in the times of World War II, of the Korean War. The American public would have rejected this as blatant war profiteering, that a company that's making good money off of contracts related to a war has been not only paying less than its 35% tax rate that it should be paying, but is actually getting money back from the U.S. government. This should be a national outrage. And keep in mind, this is the company that, Vice President Dick Cheney ran.
Well, how is it possible that they could get away with not paying any taxes?
Because what they are doing is they are by, when you are a global company and you pay the best amount of money, when you are a global company and you can pay for the best accountants in the world, what they are doing is they are shifting your profits to these tax havens, the Bermudas and the Cayman Islands, and you're making money on your books in those places, and you're making losses in places like the United States, even though overall you are very profitable. So the way that big companies can avoid paying taxes and even get tax rebates is by simply having their books show that their otherwise healthy, profitable global company is losing money in the United States and therefore should not only not pay taxes here, but should get a rebate. This is outrageous, and this is where the biggest global companies that wave the American flag, many of them in their promotion and their Madison Avenue advertising, have become the least American in terms of what they contribute to society. And this at a time, by the way, when our cities and our states have huge budget crises. Education and healthcare is crying for assistance. These companies are shirking their responsibility, and it should be seen as a national disgrace.
Well, should it be seen as tax fraud?
Well, the horror of this is that what most of them are doing is perfectly legal under our tax laws. What we have now is a system where, in the boom years of the 1980s and the 1990s, the period of market fundamentalism when everyone was worshiping free markets, these companies basically dismantled a lot of the regulation and the tax laws that had been set up to make sure that companies paid their fair share and made sure that they lived within the law. They've dismantled many of those regulations, and so they can get away with this. And this is where I think the American public caught a whiff of the corporate scandals that could emerge from all of this dismantling of regulation and tax laws last year with Enron and with WorldCom. And it's time now to finish that corporate reform agenda by closing the loopholes, closing these tax dodges, cutting out the incentives for exorbitant executive pay, and pushing a number of other important corporate reforms that will help us rebuild a real democracy in this country.
John Cavanagh, director of the Institute for Policy Studies. For more information on his report, you can visit the website at www.ips-dc.org.
It's time to bomb Iraq. It's time to shoot to kill. Cause there's a lot of empty gas tanks that's gotta be filled. So first Iraq and next Iran, and then Palestine, Syria, Pakistan. We won't stop, wait, or listen, never have, never will. It's time to bomb Iraq, time to shoot to kill, yeah. I saw the president on TV and this is what he said. We gotta smoke out evil, alive or dead. But then Bin Laden got away, I guess he's long gone. Man, this really looks bad, we better bomb Saddam. Forget about Osama, Kim Jong-il. We gotta bomb Saddam. We shoot to kill, y'all. We got a willing coalition. Russian, that's Exxon and Shell. Halliburton, Carliburton, Texaco as well.
Billy Eli from East Texas, Smoking Out Evil from the Errant Music and Arts production. Best known for her courageous work on biodiversity and anti-corporate globalization, Vandana Shiva is author of several books, including Stolen Harvest, The Hijacking of the Global Food Supply, and Water Wars. She is the founder of Navdanya, a revolutionary program in India to preserve biodiversity. KPFK's Sonali Kolhatkar spoke with Dr. Shiva recently in Southern California. We bring you an excerpt of that conversation.
The campaign against terror was used as blackmail to push free trade through. The campaign against terror became the protective force. I believe very clearly that the militarization that we are seeing, and I know for one, it's not just about Iraq, there'll be another target. They said first it was just about Afghanistan. Once they solve that one, there's going to be no more need for violence. Before you knew it, there's Iraq. Before you know it, it'll be Syria, Iran. Before you know it, it could be Kashmir and the South Asia, saying that unless the Marines land in Kashmir, this legacy of violence that the British left us with can't be solved. And again, the British will come back to help solve a problem they created, along with the U.S. Marines. This militarization is the only way a corporate globalization can keep unfolding in a period where, on the one hand, people are seeing through the game that it has no political, intellectual, moral legitimacy left. But even more importantly, in a period where those who were supposed to deliver, corporations which were supposed to be more efficient, more honest than governments, showed themselves to be what they were, the Enroning of the world. The corporations for whom all this is being done have turned out to be the worst part of the political scenario. And when the whole world no more trusts corporations, not just the people who fought against WTO in Seattle, but every person who lost a job, every person who lost their investments, there is a huge outrage against corporate control and against corporate deceit. And they cannot continue corporate rule without the defense of the military now.
In your opinion, is this war on terror, as many say, simply about oil and other resources like even water, which you're very familiar with, or is it purely empire and neo-colonialism, bringing back the sort of British-style colonialism, or is it some combination of both, or is there something we're missing?
Empire has never been without control over resources. The entire reason empires are built is to control resources. The British set out to try and get India for our cotton and our spices. Every colonizer of the world was chasing the black gold of that time, the black pepper, which used to be traded for its weight in gold. Even the tragic colonization of North America and the takeover of the land of the original Americans was because of Columbus's mistake of landing on these shores, thinking he'd arrived in India, calling the people of this land Indians, and building an accidental solidarity between every occupied community. Occupation and invasion is always for what lies in the land that is invaded. And to achieve that, two things have always been used by the colonizers. One is to define the invaded peoples, the colonized people, as not fully people. As somehow deficient. They don't know how to do democracy. They don't know how to elect their leaders. They don't know how to do development. They don't know how to value their resources. Look at them. They don't want to sell their water and their land and trade in it. Something must be wrong with these communities. So it's always the white man's burden of bringing liberation and Operation Iraqi Freedom is part of that old white man's burden, combined with finding something that people saw as sacred, something they saw as a life support, and turning it into a commodity. It began with land in the first wave of colonization, and this wave of colonization, which is globalization, backed again by the military, as that wave of globalization was backed by the gunboat, except that now the gunboats have been replaced by the A's and the B's. I say they can't go beyond A and B of the alphabet, but the missile bombers. But the logic is the same. Where does that logic come from? I feel it comes from a combination of insecurity. This whole talk of national security comes from a deeply experienced insecurity. And that insecurity, in my view, comes from a lifestyle and economic system that needs to predate on the planet to maintain itself, and therefore needs to take over the oil of every region, the water of every region, the seeds of every region, and bring it to the marketplace. The language of privatization and commodification and free trade is really so that the insatiable appetites of those in power can be met. Because otherwise people would be using that water to live, to drink, to grow their subsistence crops. They would be using their seeds to save. Therefore, you have to use intellectual property rights to make it illegal to save seeds. You have to use the World Bank loans and the conditionalities linked to them to take water away from people, as is being done with the Ganga, where the women of Garhwal, my region, have been drowned out of their homes. The remaining women are without water, so that every drop can be brought to Delhi. 635 million liters can be sold by Suez, the world's biggest water corporation. That insecurity has also, I believe, not just a material dimension, a resource dimension. I think it has a psychological dimension. And that psychological dimension is something I read through my ecological and feminist eye. Every time I have personally observed, experienced violence, it has come from those who can't stand you being autonomous, who can't stand that flower blooming on its own terms, that piece of grass coming out every year in its own logic. It's the fear of everything free on its own terms and alive on its own terms. And therefore, the logic of empire says, you're not free enough, I will give you liberation. You're not alive enough, you need to water to pass through my dam, my canal, my pipeline, then it is water. Otherwise, you can't trust your river. Your seeds are not seeds till they are genetically modified with toxins in them, then they are seeds. So there's a whole redefining of the base of survival from the self-organizing of 300 million species and 6 billion people on this planet to 5 corporations for water, 5 corporations in seed, 5 corporations in trade, and a military.
Renowned author Dr. Vandana Shiva speaking with Sonali Kolhatkar of KPFK, with the sound of the ocean rushing in the background as they sat on the beach in Southern California. A recent comment by a Christian Broadcasting Network reporter that compared Iraqi soldiers to the, quote, engines of the Old West has angered Native Americans across the country. During a March 24th report describing the position of coalition forces, CBN correspondent Paul Strand noted, quote, I'd say there are engines ahead of us, engines behind us, and engines on both sides, unquote. Suzanne Shone Harjo, who is Cheyenne and Muskogee, has fought to end the use of Native American stereotypes for 30 years. Peace Watch correspondent Jim Kent spoke with her about the issue.
Well, my first reaction is engine. I mean, what a throwback. It really is illustrative of America's love-hate relationship with Native Americans that really goes back to the federal boarding school days, the kill the Indian, save the man, kill the savage, save the man. The reporters, and not just the war talk, but the military talk as well, really talk about us like we're not here, and that it's okay to demean us because we're dead, gone, buried, forgotten, or to mascot us, or to steal our stuff, you know, from land to culture to names. And it's still military talk to say that someone's roamed off the reservation, you know, a throwback to the days when it was a criminal offense for Native Americans to roam off the reservation. It, more than what this reporter said, it's really jarring to me to hear about the 7th Cavalry's Apache troop and Crazy Horse troop. I mean, what is the thinking there? I had just kind of gotten used to the Apache helicopter, and then I heard one commentator and a military spokesman say something about the Kiowa helicopter. I presume that means Kiowa. So they don't even know how to pronounce it, but they're perfectly willing to steal the name of a living, viable Native nation. No one ever said reporters are the brightest people in the world. And it is a little comfort to know that we're not the only ones they're ragging on. There's, I heard the other day on one of the cable television shows, one announcer say the Shiite just hit the fan. And this is really stunning ignorance. The person didn't even realize, besides being just a terrible thing to say, a pejorative thing to say, didn't even realize who's fighting who over there, and that Saddam Hussein is a Sunni and is not a fan of the Shiites, and they don't have much good to say about him either. But imagine saying something like that, and that was on MSNBC. It's really hard to keep watching this in progress when you're constantly being hit by these little missiles that demean people's culture just because they're not in the mainstream of American thought. But it's top down and bottom up. It's pervasive.
Now, when I spoke to Angel and mentioned this to her, she didn't really seem to have a problem with it. She said, "Oh yeah, you know, engines, like a throwback to the Wild West days," and you know, so it's not just unfortunately, it's not isolated to the reporters and the media and people in military positions. It seems to be throughout the American mainstream culture. Can you comment on
that? That's right. Well, this is the stuff that makes the mascotting of Native Americans acceptable in polite society when it shouldn't be. These really racist slurs and practices and behaviors, the tomahawk chop, for heaven's sakes, that sort of thing. There are lots and lots of people in American society who don't even realize that there's something wrong with that, and don't realize that there's something wrong with the 7th Cavalry taking the name of Crazy Horse for one of its troops. Now, I'm sure they would say that it's a great honor, and they mean well, and they only use names that are elevating of the person or the entity named. But when you think about the other troops and their names, the Desert Rats, I don't know that it's such an honor, and I don't think that the Teochpa'e of Crazy Horse would be real happy with that. I just wonder what people are thinking about, what the thought process is that goes into the stealing of Native nations' names and historical figures' names. I just don't understand that. I think it does have to do with the fact that we are perceived as no longer living and not quite human, and that our stuff is up for grabs.
Native American activist Suzanne Shone Harjo speaking with Peace Watch correspondent Jim Kent. Finally tonight, we present this musical mix from Peter Beauchamp at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York City.
Only one thing holds this country from war today. That is the rising opposition of the American people.
The forces of war and the forces of peace are suited up on the battlefield of justice. Who wins depends on who is best prepared and most committed.
We will act with the full power of the United States military. We will act with allies at our side, and we will prevail.
There will be no meaningful solution until some attempt is made to know these people, hear their broken cry. They must see Americans as strange liberators. The only change came from America as we increased our true commitment in support of governments which were singularly corrupt, inept, and without popular support for our government. And the press generally won't tell us these things, but God told me to tell you this morning. The truth must be told.
It's up to you not to heed the call of...
I know there's another battle, and there will be another battle after that, and there will be another battle after that.
Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer this evening was T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. And our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adel Hamid of KPFA, Benta Berklin and Fidel Rodriguez. Thanks to Pete Karakis, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. Without your financial support, Peace Watch will cease to exist as of May 1st. It's your financial support that makes this program possible. So we urge you to make your pledge through our secure online website at pacifica.org. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. Send us your feedback at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. We leave you tonight with Prince, Love, Thy Will Be Done. Thank you for listening.